Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to It's Rainmaking Time. At a time when the G20 have announced and decreed the call for the end of the dollar and a new supercurrency, an international supercurrency, as special drawing rights are becoming more formally used as a form of a basket of currencies, now is the time to understand clearly what's at work. And not only is it the time to understand what's at work, ladies and gentlemen, it's the time to understand why metals are so important. Gold, silver, platinum. And I've met a lot of people in the metals industry and in the finance industry, but I must tell you, our guest today, I call the Yoda of the metals industry because he's so wise and his knowledge is so far-reaching. I've never heard the synthesis of explanation and understanding the way I have with James Turk. James Turk is the founder and chairman of Gold Money, a riveting, convenient, and economical way to buy and sell gold, silver, platinum online using digital gold currency. He was awarded 4 U.S. patents, specializing most of his life in international banking, finance, and investments. As he graduated from George Washington University with a BA degree in international economics, he began his business career with Chase Manhattan Bank, now JP Morgan Chase, which included assignments in Thailand, the Philippines, and Hong Kong. In 1980, he joined the private investment and trading company of a prominent precious metals trader. He moved to the United Arab Emirates in December of 1983 to be appointed manager of the commodity department of the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. This position he held until resigning in 1987 to begin the Free Gold Money Report. He's written several monographs on money and banking. He is the co-author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar, now available in a paperback version entitled The Collapse of the Dollar. Please welcome the Yoda of Metals, James Turk.
Hi, Kim. Thank you for that introduction.
It's true. You are the Yoda of the metals industry, and I've never heard anybody put it together the way you have.
Thank you very much.
Let's go right into your book, The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. You say in this book that gold is not a commodity like eggs. For the general populace who does not have historical background into gold and silver, you say, and it has been said that gold is money. It's sound money. What does that mean?
Yeah, gold is different from everything else we humans produce. Everything we produce is consumed and disappears. But gold is different. It's accumulated. It's hoarded. And in order to understand this, all of the gold mined throughout history still exists today in this above-ground stock, which comprises approximately 160,000 metric tons, which, to look at it visually, is approximately the bottom one-fifth of the Washington Monument. And to put that into perspective, there's 20 times more steel poured every day than there has been gold mined throughout history. But the question is, why does gold have this value? It has value because its usefulness is a monetary unit of account. Gold preserves purchasing power over long periods of time. So it's different from other commodities. These other commodities, soybeans, crude oil, you know, they disappear. Even copper disappears in a sense that it's dispersed through millions of applications, and you'll throw away a spare piece of copper wire. But if you have a piece of broken gold jewelry, you don't throw that away. You put it in the drawer until eventually you have it fixed or replaced or repaired.
You say, and it is said through 5,000 years of history, that fiat currencies always fail. If that's so, for the general listening audience, why is that so, and then why are we using it? Why are we using paper currencies?
Well, first of all, you know, when you have paper currency was invented as a convenience. You know, if you look at the history of money and currency, and I like to distinguish between the two because they are different. The history of money and currency are different. You know, money does the same thing today that it did 5,000 years ago. Money is what I call a mental tool. It's something that we use for interacting with each other when we go into the marketplace to fulfill our needs and wants. And currency is what we actually use day to day, hand to hand, when we go into the marketplace. And there are basically two types of currency. There's paper currency, you know, the cash in our pocket. And then there's deposit currency, which is the money that moves around within the banking system. But, you know, these two forms of currency are really a matter of convenience because it's too difficult to move gold coins around. And, you know, the logic had been that, you know, gold is too valuable to move around because it wears out. So let's leave the gold and silver in the vault and make these paper currencies redeemable into gold and silver that sits safely and secure in the vault. But what we've done is we've moved away from that redeemability, and we now just have pieces of paper out there circulating, you know, backed by nothing. And the reason why paper currency, fiat, by the way, means just currency that's issued by a government and circulates because of government force. It's a Latin word. And this fiat currency circulates because of rules and laws and regulations, you know, by the government. But the reason why it fails is when you eliminate the link to gold, when you eliminate that redeemability back into gold, an infinite amount of paper currency can be created. The only thing that stops a government from issuing an infinite amount of paper currency is discipline. And unfortunately, politicians and governments don't have that self-discipline, and inevitably they issue more and more currency until eventually they reach that breaking point where confidence in the currency collapses, and the currency then collapses as a result. And my view is that, you know, the dollar has been on this road. This is what John Rubino and I laid out in our book, The Collapse of the Dollar. The dollar is on this road to what I call the fiat currency graveyard. You know, there are hundreds of other fiat currencies that are buried there. And unless we get off this road, the dollar will be there too. And I think it's going to get there pretty soon because we're reaching the point now with the U.S. dollar that the lack of discipline on politicians in terms of creating money is becoming increasingly apparent. And the confidence in the dollar is breaking. It's already broken badly internationally, and I think it's starting to break domestically with the rise in the gold price over $1,000 an ounce.
Do you actually think at this time that free markets really exist anymore? I know it's a difficult question, but do you think they really exist anymore at this time, the way things are operating?
Yeah, they do. You know, when two individuals interact with one another and they do so without the force of government, they are operating in a free market. They don't have to use a national currency to transact. They can use other currencies to transact. But as far as government involvement is concerned and markets in general, you know, free markets are becoming, let's say, imperiled by government actions. And the thing that I really don't like to see happen, Kim, is that rather than turning to the free market for answers, more and more people are turning increasingly to government for answers. And that's really the wrong way because goods and services come from the free market. You know, new ideas, new technologies, they come from the free market. They don't come from government. You know, all government basically does is take away from producers and redistribute it according to how it wants to redistribute wealth. But it's the free markets that create real wealth, and it's the free markets that raise mankind's or humankind's standards of living. So we should be looking to the free market for answers rather than government. And unfortunately, for now, you know, we continue to look toward government. That's really the wrong way.
Most of the money that's being printed is referred to as M3. Could you explain what M3 is and then explain why it is that the amount of money being printed as M3 does not equate an equal and balance to the goods and services that are being made available and why that's a problem?
Yeah, okay. First of all, M3 is just a definition of the quantity of money. You have M1, M2, M3, M3 being the broadest, and it basically includes all dollars in circulation. And by dollars in circulation, I mentioned earlier the two different types of dollars, you know, the paper currency, the green notes that we carry around in our pockets, and then the deposit currency that we have sitting in our accounts and in banks that circulates by check, wire transfer, and plastic card. M3 encompasses basically all of that currency, and the issue that's happening is M3 is growing more rapidly than economic activity. One of the reasons why gold has emerged as money over thousands of years is that this above-ground stock of gold grows very consistently. It grows by approximately 1.7% per annum. You know, every year it gets 1.7% larger. And that's approximately equal to new wealth creation and also approximately equal to world population growth. So you have this consistency in gold's purchasing power. So I can, you know, look today and see that an ounce of gold buys the same amount, the same barrels of crude oil that it did 40 years ago or 50 years ago. Or an ounce of gold today buys a Colt 45 handgun, which is what it took to buy a Colt 45 handgun in the Wild West back in the 1880s. And they also say an ounce of gold today buys a good man's suit. An ounce of gold in Roman times bought a good toga for a Roman senator. So you have this above-ground stock of gold growing by approximately the same as new wealth creation and world population growth. So you have this consistency. Whereas the money that's created by government, you know, M3, you know, dollars and even the other currencies, there is no consistency to the growth rate. You know, recently we saw M3 growing as rapidly as 19% per annum. This was last year. And over the past year, it's gone down to about 1.5% per annum. So this volatility in M3 growth basically makes the currency less effective, because the purchasing power of the currency can change very dramatically by just changing the growth in M3. Now, that's one half of the equation, these M's, M1, M2, M3. These deal with the quantity of currency in circulation. But as we know, price is a function of supply and demand. So it's the demand for dollars that are also important in order to determine, you know, the dollar's price. Or when we talk about money, we mean purchasing power, not price. So the purchasing power of the dollar is a function of both supply and demand. And the problem that the dollar is facing now is that the demand for the dollar is falling dramatically around the world. You know, we see this all of the time. Central banks diversifying out of the dollar, central banks buying gold, individuals buying gold, diversifying out of the dollar to minimize dollar holdings. So the dollar is losing purchasing power, even though M3 growth rates have been declining over the past year.
Why do you think it is that the average public has a perception of owning gold as risky and sees it as potential confiscation, like it's something that can be confiscated, so since it was done in the past, don't get involved with it now? And yet, at the same time, the average person feels seemingly very comfortable having U.S. dollars in banks, even though there's a decree by the G20 and leaders of the world that they want to get rid of the dollar. What is that about?
Yeah, it's really crazy, isn't it? There's no logic to it. It's all emotion. You know, for 100 years, governments have been at war with gold. Up until 1914, national currencies were on the classical gold standard. And under the classical gold standard, which was invented by Sir Isaac Newton in 1700.
I didn't know that. I don't think
that. He invented it. It's actually an interesting story. The Bank of England was established in 1694. Again, this was an advancement in the form of currency. Instead of using silver coin, which was the coin of the realm in Britain at the time, the Bank of England said, keep the coin in the vault and we'll use these banknotes, pieces of paper, you know, cash currency instead, and let that circulate as currency instead of coin. Well, it was a good idea because it was a more efficient form of currency. And the first bank crisis occurred 2 years later in 1696 when the Bank of England had issued too much paper relative to the amount of currency in circulation. Now, at the time, this is when John Locke, for example, wrote his treatise on silver and, you know, commented on the debasement of the currency that was being pursued by the Bank of England. But at the time, King William did not have, the finances of the crown were very poor. He was fighting wars against France. The Stuarts had, monarchy had just been overthrown in the Glorious Revolution of 1688. So he was still worried about being usurped by the possible, you know, Stuarts, or what they called pretenders to the throne. So he was strapped for cash, and the Bank of England basically came up with a way of financing the wars and the money that he needed in exchange for the royal charter that was given to the Bank of England. But the monetary turmoil that was created by the banking crisis in 1696 had King William perplexed. So he said to, he turned to the brightest mind of the day, Sir Isaac Newton, and said, you know, figure this all out. And what Newton did is he essentially created the rules of the classical gold standard, turned Britain into a gold standard-based economy, and the British pound, which is basically another way of saying gold, reigned supreme for 214 years until 1914. So it was a complementary relationship between gold and national currencies under the classical gold standard. And what central banks did under the classical gold standard is they managed the currency in order to make certain that a pound always had the purchasing power of gold at the weight that it was defined. One British pound was 0.2435 ounces of gold. And so it was. So a pound in 1914 had essentially the same purchasing power that a British pound did in 1700 in terms of buying, you know, bushels of wheat, or, you know, commodities and things of that nature. So, you know, the classical gold standard was a complementary relationship. But, you know, getting to where we are now and where we've been really for the last 100 years, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, governments and central banks realized that they didn't have to follow Newton's rules, which were voluntary. And if they could control gold and move away from the gold standard, they could create fiat money and create as much money as they wanted out of thin air in order to pursue their objectives. You know, the way I put it is that, you know, governments need power, they therefore need guns, but they can't create guns out of thin air, so they create fiat money out of thin air to buy guns. And that's basically the system that we've had for the past 100 years. And gold plays a key element of that, because gold is really the natural form of money, and if you can suppress the price of gold, you make fiat currencies look better. Anyway, from 1914 to the present, instead of having a complementary relationship between gold and national currencies, it's been a competitive relationship. Then governments have been trying to, you know, fight gold and keep gold controlled to make national currencies look better. But we've reached a stage where I think that essentially, despite all of the government propaganda, which is why people think gold is risky, despite all of the government propaganda and the power, we've reached a stage where I think the end of the dollar is within sight. National currencies are probably going to collapse if the dollar collapses, and we're going to go back to a new system. Now, the people that brought us the fiat currencies and the unconstitutional dollar system that we now have are going to probably try to bring in more fiat currencies at a supranational level, like the euro in Europe, or like rumors have been talked about the Amero in the United States, Canada, and Mexico for a North American currency to compete with the euro. But the question is whether or not the American people, Canadian people, and the Mexican people allow that to happen.
I understand this morning from your free gold money report that the euro is in trouble and spiraling out of control. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, right now, most of the currencies of the world are backed by U.S. dollars. Most bank reserves today are not gold. Most bank reserves today are U.S. dollars. And that's particularly true for the euro. So if the U.S. dollar collapses and goes into a black hole, the gravitational pull will pull other currencies along with it. Unless those currencies get rid of the dollars as reserves and back their currencies by gold or silver.
Do you think that's possible?
That the dollar is going to go in the black hole? Yeah.
You know, whatever new currency evolves or is put into place can or will be backed by gold or silver.
Well, what my hope is that, and what we aim to do in gold money, is to give people the opportunity to transact in gold outside of national currency systems. So you can completely void fiat currency and just transact in gold or in silver.
There's this psychology for most people that, A, if you buy gold, you should have it with you. B, there's a lot of people that still think leveraging gold and ETFs and buying contracts for gold is the same, which you've stated clearly in your book, it is not. But the other thing is there is this psychology that if the gold is stored away from you physically, it's not within your reach, that somehow psychologically there's more risk. But yet when I look inside the banks and look at what's going on with currencies, I see more risk because governments can come in, make decrees, leaders of different governments can get together, make secret deals, and say, we're ending this, it's over, and the rest of us are sitting here like sitting ducks. So in your system that you created, which I think is elegant, but I still think is like a well-kept secret, even though, you know, you have huge reserves now, when you're storing gold and transacting business using gold money, which involves gold, silver, and platinum, it's stored in a vault. But what happens with that vault? Take the listeners into what happens and how is it really protected? Because I bet you money in the mind of 90% of the public that this feels foreign and they're not used to having anything they own separated from them.
Yeah, there are a number of points there. First of all, let me start from a big picture point of view. There's a difference between physical gold and paper gold. You know, I talk to people all over the world, and they say, well, they own gold. And then when I ask them about it, they really own paper gold. They don't own physical gold. You know, they'll own an ETF. They'll own a bank certificate, or they'll have a pool account or something like that. In other words, they own exposure to the gold price. They don't, and that exposure to the gold price comes with counterparty risk. In other words, they're dependent upon someone's promise to make good if the gold price rises and pay them some national currency in return or to deliver physical metal to them if they have that type of a contract. But basically, paper gold has counterparty risk. Physical gold does not. Paper gold is a financial asset. Physical gold is a tangible asset. There's a fundamental difference between those because when you own physical gold, you do not have counterparty risk. You're not dependent on some bank's or some government's balance sheet. Now, when you buy physical gold, there are basically two ways to do it. You either buy it and you store it yourself, or you buy it and you have someone store it for you, which is what we do in gold money. Now, both of these alternatives have advantages and disadvantages. When you buy it and store it yourself, you have it in hand, but how much gold are you going to store in your basement or bury it in the backyard? And if you're talking about silver, which is presently about 60 times the volume for the same amount of dollars as gold, you know, where are you going to put all of that silver? And are you going to run the risk of the U.S. government confiscating, you know, gold again like they did from 1933 until 1974 by having it in buried in your backyard or having it in your house? Now, the other alternative is to have someone store it for you. But when you use this alternative, you need the assurances of integrity that the gold and silver are absolutely safe. And what we do in gold money is we have independent third-party verification by two different groups of auditors every other month going in and confirming that all of the gold is there, all of the silver is there, and platinum too, and that it's equal to the quantity of precious metals that are owned by our customers. So our customers have the assurances of integrity that the gold and silver are there. So the difference between owning physical gold and storing it yourself or having someone store it for you depends upon performance risk. You know, we talked about counterparty risk when you had paper gold. Physical gold has a type of performance risk. First of all, if you store it yourself, the stuff that you're buying, you have to be absolutely certain that it really is gold and not gold-plated lead or gold-plated tungsten or counterfeit coins that look like real gold but really aren't real gold. So you always have to be dealing with someone who is completely trustworthy.
What makes somebody trustworthy then?
Well, there are a number of different things. Basically, the reputation, the time in business, but more importantly, you know, the control mechanisms that they use. Now, what we do in gold money is we have various governance procedures and the auditing and things of this nature. And the audit reports, which are these independent third-party verifications, they're available to our customers upon request. So because, you know, it's economical and convenient and also, importantly, very safe. We've grown very rapidly, and we're now storing over $900 billion of gold and silver that's owned by our customers.
So my question is, with this advanced governance model that is transparent, with the fall of AIG and the behavior of a company like AIG as an insurance company, and we know that gold money is insured, that everything in these vaults is insured, what happens if Lloyd's of London goes belly up? Then what happens to the insurance policy? And I bring this up to deal with practical realities that people have in their heads who want to buy gold money, but because other insurance companies have acted improperly and cook their books or had bad assets, toxic assets, or credit default swaps, or other shenanigans going on with derivatives, how do you keep the insurance company that's connected with your company clean? Or how do you make sure that they're acting properly?
Well, first of all, the insurance only comes into play if the gold is stolen, if there's some kind of theft of the gold or silver or the platinum. And all of the metal is contained in highly specialized bullion vaults that are very, very secure, and the likelihood of a theft from a bullion vault is very, very low. So you first have to have the theft from the bullion vault, and then at the same time have the insurance company go under, and it's just a very, very unlikely occurrence to have both of those things happen at the same time. We do use Lloyd's of London to underwrite the insurance, and we always have the insurance with first-class insurance companies.
It's an important question. It's also, in gold money, how do you assure the people that are taking their money and buying gold and silver and platinum that a government that decides they don't like you can't come in and confiscate the money in the bullion vaults?
Yeah. You know, this has been something that's been on our mind even before we formed the company. You know, I am American, but we formed Gold Money in Europe. Gold Money is a European company, European-based and European-operated. And the reason is that the U.S. confiscated gold once before, and gold has never been confiscated in Europe. What we've also done is we're operating in the British Channel Islands, the island of Jersey, which basically relies on traditional Anglo-Saxon common law, the basic principles of which are property rights. So the island of Jersey has become a major financial center in the world. There's over $1 trillion of assets managed there because of the reliance on traditional Anglo-Saxon common law. And then what we do is we store the gold for our customers, the gold that our customers own, in vaults either in London or in Zurich, and the customer can choose where he wants to place his gold. And in the new year, we hope to have an additional vault in Hong Kong, and over time, we're going to have additional vaults around the world. So customers can choose to place their gold in different jurisdictions, different countries where they may feel comfortable, or perhaps diversify their gold and silver holdings among several different countries, because you don't want to take risks with your gold and silver. It's the bedrock asset in your portfolio. So by diversifying it geographically, you know, you're mitigating the risk to help protect your metal that way too.
I usually tell people, think of gold as a huge savings account, a wealth building account, and don't think of your currency anymore as wealth building. Am I correct when I tell them that?
You're absolutely right, and this is basically what I've been saying all decade long. You know, first of all, savings are always a good thing. It's always a good thing to save money, but it's a particularly good thing when you're saving sound money. I mean, look at it this way. 8 years in a row, gold is up against the U.S. dollar at an average annual return of 16.3% on average per annum. This year, it's going to be the ninth year in a row that gold is up against the U.S. dollar, and at the moment, we're up about 30%. This year. If you put $100 in a savings account or in a bank account, you know, at the end of the year, you're going to get $102, but your purchasing power is only going to be like $92 or $93. We have negative real interest rates. By putting money in a bank, you're actually losing purchasing power, and what you really should be doing is measuring one's purchasing power, not how many dollars you have or how many euros you have, but how much purchasing power you have.
And how do people do that?
Well, you have to calculate the price of goods and services in terms of gold. And that's why I'm very fond of using these examples of saying that an ounce of gold today still buys the same amount of crude oil it did 50 years ago. So despite the fact that gold is up, you know, 16% for 8 years in a row and 30% against the dollar this year, an ounce of gold still basically buys the same amount of crude oil. Here's another example. You know, I remember as a kid in the 1950s growing up in the States, my parents could fill the family car with two silver dollars. And that would buy enough gasoline to fill the family car. Well, if you take two silver dollars today and you take it at the market value, which is approximately $36, you can fill up the family car. So you have to calculate the price of goods and services in terms of gold and silver to truly understand how the dollar is being debased. know, how you're losing purchasing power by continuing to hang on dollars instead of looking at other alternatives like gold and silver.
What is this fear index that's on your free gold money report?
Yeah, what that does is it sort of, I use it a number of different ways. Basically, I use it as an indicator, you know, whether the trend in gold is up or down. We got a buy signal of the fear index back in May of 2002, and we continue in a buying mode, indicating that the trend for gold continues to go higher. But basically, I use it most importantly for a indication of gold's relative value. And the way it's calculated is I take the gold in Fort Knox, the U.S. Gold Reserve, determine its market value and divide it by M3, and I get a percent. And it basically says what percent of the U.S. dollar is backed by gold and what percent of the U.S. dollar is backed by debt, because that's basically the rest of the U.S. dollar. You know, when a bank makes a loan, they're creating dollars and they're putting debt on the balance sheet, and that's what's backing the dollar. So it's either gold or debts in government debt or commercial debts on bank balance sheets. Now, historically, it would normally be about 40%. That's what it was typically when the British pound reigned supreme, because you can calculate the fair index for every currency. In other words, it meant that 40% of the paper currency issued by the Bank of England was backed by gold. In the 19th century, as new forms of currency developed, checking accounts and things of that nature, the amount of backing tended to fall, and by the beginning of the 20th century, it was closer to 15% to 20% or so was backed by gold, and the rest was backed by debt. In the 1920s, during the boom, the fair index fell to 10%. In other words, 10% gold backing for the U.S. dollar. During the Depression, it rose back to 38%, almost 40%, the dollar backed by gold. And then since then, we've basically been in a long decline. In the early 1970s, the fear index was 1.7%, meaning $1.70 of every $100 of M3 was backed by gold, the rest was backed by debt. The fear index rose to 10% in 1980, and today we're 2.1%. So the fear index is still relatively low. If the fear index were to go to 10%, as it did in 1980, the gold price would have to increase by about five times, and M3 would have to remain unchanged. So on a relative basis, the fear index is still very low. And as fiat currency becomes increasingly doubted, the fear index is going to rise. And the name implies what the fear index does. As people have fear about the purchasing power of national currencies, the fear index rises because the gold price is rising in terms of that currency.
I want to go back. Thank you for answering that. I want to go back to something that confuses me. And if people are paying attention, it may confuse them. Which is, you know, when you just a couple of minutes ago, before we talked about the fear index, you were saying, and I'm paraphrasing, basically that an ounce of gold could buy the same ounce of gold for oil.
An ounce of gold today buys the same number of barrels of crude oil that it could 40 years ago or 50 years ago or even 20 years ago or 10 years ago.
See, I don't understand that. Let me just tell you what I don't understand. And the reason I don't understand it is, because if the reserve currency for purchasing oil is the U.S. dollar, how is that possible? It's confusing to me. Like, could you explain it a little?
Yeah, it's not just oil that has, you know, that has this consistency, you know, to gold's purchasing power. You know, we look at the price of oil, and in 1950, the price of oil was $1.17 a barrel. Last year it went up to 150, and, you know, today it's still around 76 or 7, it's gone back up to 76 or 78, dollars, per barrel. And therefore, we think that the price of oil is becoming more expensive. But what's really happening is that the purchasing power of the dollar is declining. And that's why I say an ounce of gold buys the same number of barrels of crude oil as it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 50 years ago. You know, there are some small fluctuations, but those are just things that are normal occurrences in terms of supply and demand. So it's that the dollar is losing value. And in order to truly understand what's happening to the dollar, you have to calculate the price of goods and services in terms of gold. Now, and not only tangible assets like gold, like crude oil. But also, financial assets can be calculated in terms of gold. And one of the things I like to do is look at the price of the Dow Jones Industrials in terms of gold.
Explain what that is. Explain what the Dow Jones Industrial is to the common person.
Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, we normally think of it in terms of dollars, you know, and it's $10,000 or $14,000 or whatever the number, $10,000 or $14,000 in the Dow, that's basically a dollar calculation. But what we can do is we can go back throughout history and find out, what the dollar gold exchange rate was and then determine what the Dow Jones Industrial actually was in terms of gold. And back in the 1930s, the Dow at its low was 35, and an ounce of gold was 35. So there was this one-to-one relationship between the Dow and the gold, which was the exact opposite of where it was in 1929. It took over 20 ounces of gold to equal the Dow Jones Industrials. Then in 1968, it took 35 ounces of gold to equal the Dow Jones Industrials, or approximately 35. But by 1980, the Dow was 800 and gold was 800. So you came back to this one-to-one relationship. 1 ounce of gold equaled the Dow. In 2000, it took 42 ounces of gold to equal the Dow Jones, giving an indication of how overvalued stocks were and how undervalued gold was. And today it still takes about 9 or 10 ounces of gold to equal the Dow, depending on what day it is and the week and whether the Dow's up or down and whether gold's up or down at that moment in time. But at some point in time in the future, I think we're going to see the end of this boom-bust cycle where 1 ounce of gold again equals to the Dow. In fact, I was interviewed back in October of 2003 when gold was around $340, $350 an ounce. I was interviewed by Barron's, the financial newspaper in the States. And they asked me to project the price of gold, and I used this comparison. And I said at the, we have two previous boom-bust cycles. At the end of those previous boom-bust cycles in the 1930s and in 1980, 1 ounce of gold equaled the Dow. And I said, it's going to probably take 10 to 12 years. So this was 2003, so I was saying 2013 to 2015 for this next bust to end. And when it does end, 1 ounce of gold will equal the Dow. And they said, well, that's interesting, but put a dollar price on it. And I said, you can't really predict the dollar price because it depends whether the Federal Reserve inflates or deflates. And they said, well, take a guess. And I said, well, the history of the Federal Reserve is basically one of inflation, so they're probably going to inflate. So I said to Barron's that in 2013 or 2015, 1 ounce of gold will equal the Dow. The Dow will be 8,000 and gold will be 8,000. Now, it sounds outrageous. But if you remember back in October 2003, gold was about $350, 10 times more than it was when it was $35 in 1971. But it took $10 in October 2003 to purchase what $1 purchased in 1971. So gold in 1971 went from $35 to $800 by 1980. So I was basically saying that the dollar, which had only one-tenth of the purchasing power that it did back in the 70s, was going to take gold from 350 to 8,000. I was basically saying that history was going to repeat. But basically, given what's happened in the Federal Reserve since then, and particularly in the last couple of years, I think my upside forecast for the gold price is too conservative, and I think we're going to see a gold price over $8,000 because I think the U.S. dollar is very, very close to hyperinflation.
Explain what that is.
Well, hyperinflation basically means a very rapid increase in the money supply, a very rapid decrease in the demand for currency. And it essentially translates or manifests itself as rapidly rising prices. And when we talk about hyperinflation, there's a lot of misconception. People look at Weimar Germany in the 1920s and they see, people moving paper currency around by wheelbarrows and bushel baskets, or they look at what happened in Zimbabwe more recently and the terrible hyperinflation that that country had. And that's one kind of hyperinflation. It's a paper currency hyperinflation. But Argentina and other Latin American countries in the 1980s and early 1990s had a different type of hyperinflation. They had a deposit currency hyperinflation. The currency was hyperinflated by creating more deposit currency within the banking system. And so hyperinflation appears in two different forms. You have this paper currency hyperinflation or a deposit currency hyperinflation, and it depends on the nature of the banking system in the country. In Weimar Germany and in Zimbabwe, very few people had bank accounts. Almost all commerce was conducted with paper currency. You know, even the government at the end of the month would hand out paper currency to its employees rather than giving people a check because there were so few people with bank accounts. Argentina, on the other hand, in 1991, had a very sophisticated banking system. Almost everyone had a bank account, and very little commerce was conducted by paper. Almost all commerce was conducted by bank checks, wire transfers, or plastic cards. So they ended up having a deposit currency hyperinflation. But here's the important point. Regardless whether you have a sophisticated or unsophisticated banking system, and regardless whether hyperinflation occurs as a paper currency hyperinflation or deposit currency hyperinflation, hyperinflation always has the same cause. It's government spending too much money, forcing the government to borrow more than what the market is willing to lend to the government. So the central bank steps in and buys that government debt and turns it into currency. In the case of Weimar Germany, they ran the printing presses. In the case of Argentina, they ran the bookkeeping machines or the computers by adding zeros to the government's checking account, and the government then wrote checks to create the hyperinflation. Now, I went to Argentina in 1991 specifically to analyze what was happening there. The currency at the time was the austral, and in January of 1991, the austral was 14 to 1, 14 australs to purchase one U.S. dollar. It had been a fixed link, and they broke the link, and they started devaluing the currency. When I arrived the first week of May, the austral had already devalued to 64, so it took 64 australs to purchase one U.S. dollar. When I left at the end of the week, it was 96 australs to purchase one U.S. dollar. In December of that year, it took 10,000 australs to purchase one U.S. dollar. I think the U.S. dollar is on the road to an Argentine-style hyperinflation, because what was happening in Argentina is exactly what's happening now in the United States. The Argentine government was spending more than money than it had on hand, forcing it to borrow. It was borrowing more than the market was willing to lend to it. So the Reserve Bank of Argentina, the Central Bank of Argentina, stepped in, bought the government debt, and created australs out of thin air and put them in the government's checking account, which the government spent. What's happening in the United States today is the U.S. government is creating these huge deficits.
Is it really the U.S. government? I really want to get the terms right. Is it really the U.S. government that's creating the debt?
Yes, it's the U.S. government is spending much more than it has in revenues. It has huge deficits, and so it's building up a tremendous amount of debt. There is debt obviously being created elsewhere in the U.S. as well, but it's the government debt that turns into hyperinflation, because what happens is the government's spending so much more than it's receiving in revenue. It has to go into the market to borrow those dollars, but the market is not willing to lend all of those dollars back to the government because there just isn't the capacity for it. So the central bank steps in. The Federal Reserve is calling it quantitative easing, but they're basically doing the same thing the Central Bank of Argentina did. They're buying U.S. government debt, they're turning that U.S. government debt into currency by creating more dollars out of thin air by adding it to the U.S. government's checking account, which the U.S. government then writes checks on to spend. So we're on the road to hyperinflation, because hyperinflation always has the same. It's not from banks lending too much. It's from government spending too much. And that's overspending causing them to borrow more than the market's willing to lend, and the central bank turns that into currency. Now, when I was in Argentina, we were at the tipping point. You could sense it in the way shopkeepers were acting and the general population was acting. They knew it was coming because they had gone through hyperinflation before, and they were taking steps to protect themselves, you know, buying gold and silver, getting rid of financial assets, and, you know, basically making sure they had hard currency or tangible assets to protect themselves from a collapse of the currency. Now, the demand for the Argentine Austral was declining very rapidly. People were getting out of the Australs as quickly as they could. The same thing is happening with the U.S. dollar internationally. The demand for the dollar is falling internationally, with central banks getting out of the dollar, foreign dollar holders exiting the dollar, buying gold and anything tangible. The key point, though, is that the dollar domestically has not yet reached the tipping point, but I think it's probably going to happen very soon, because people sense that the U.S. government cannot create these huge trillion-dollar deficits without consequences, and they see the gold price rising, so they know something's going wrong with the monetary system with this rapidly rising gold price. So I think you're going to reach the tipping point domestically very, very soon within the U.S., and typically, if monetary history is any guide, you've got 6 to 10 months or so before a currency totally collapses once the tipping point is reached. What the U.S. government has to do is it has to get off this road to the fiat currency graveyard, do an about-face, read the Constitution, go back to the system that we had previously where the dollar was tied to a weight of gold or a weight of silver, and, you know, go back to a sound money basis. I don't think the government's going to do that. I don't think they're going to reinstitute constitutional money. I think they're going to continue in this direction. They probably will impose capital controls, which is another thing governments do to try to keep the fiat currency game going longer. What the nature of those controls will be is anyone's guess, but it basically will restrict your freedom to do what you want with your dollar currency. So unfortunately the way we're headed, I believe.
Why do you think it is? And there's three very pivotal questions I have for you, and I thought we'd just go boom, boom, boom. Number one, there are so many people who psychologically believe that they're covered by the FDIC, totally covered, protected, no worries, the government will handle it, whatever's in the bank is handled.
Well, that's an easy one. It's easier to believe what you hear on the television than it is to actually go out and analyze the FDIC's balance sheet. When you actually go out and analyze the FDIC's balance sheet and look at it in relation to the overall government finances, you'll see that the FDIC is insolvent. It's only, you know, remained afloat because of government backing. But, you know, eventually, all of these things that government is backing, just like Fannie Mae, you know, eventually collapsed, all these other things are going to eventually collapse as well, because the government can't create wealth out of thin air. It just creates paper money out of thin air, and paper money is not wealth. And eventually, the FDIC is just going to, you know, fall apart as well, just like Fannie Mae fell apart. It's just a question of time.
And
next question.
My concern is that the good faith in lending and the confidence in currency, which is perceived as money, that the average public person, the average individual, is going to have complexity with regard to letting go and using gold money as money, because they've lost faith and they've lost confidence. In other words, are you concerned that the baby called gold money will be thrown out with the bathwater called toxic waste and a falling, crashing dollar, that you will somehow get lost in the mix?
Yeah. No, I'm not concerned about that. First of all, you bring up a very good point about confidence, because when confidence goes, that's when you've reached the tipping point and people start exiting the currency, you know, because they sense that the currency is starting to collapse. And that's ultimately what leads to the hyperinflation. And what we've done with gold money is we've done a number of things. First of all, as I mentioned, we're European-based. We're based in British Channel Islands. One of the reasons why we're there, as I explained, is because it relies on traditional Anglo-Saxon common law. But it also is a place where property rights are very much protected. You know, you don't have politicians interfering with private property or politicians interfering with the monetary system and things of that nature. So, you know, we believe that regardless what happens to the U.S. dollar, you know, gold money is going to continue to operate, because people around the world find, you know, gold money to be very, very useful in terms of, you know, their own situation, be they corporations or individuals.
Okay.
We think gold money is well positioned and to take advantage of the chaos. And in fact, it is the answer for the chaos. because it's a very efficient, modern, economical, and safe way of transacting with one another with sound currency. So we think that gold money's role in the future will become increasingly important as national currencies become less important because of the mismanagement by central banks and governments.
I have a few more questions, but very important is typically when you're dealing with currencies personally or in business, you are operating inside an accounting universe. How do people transition psychologically and on a protocol level in terms of accounting for the transactions that are being had through gold money, using gold as money with regard to reporting? Do you have any suggestions about that? Going to be different, isn't it?
Yeah. I can't give tax advice and things like that. You know, that's not our business. We're in the business of gold and silver. And the other thing that we do is we follow the rules and the laws in the country where we operate, which is the British Channel Islands. We don't do any external reporting. We require in our user agreements that our users comply with the rules and regulations from where they access gold money. But because we're not allowed to do any external reporting to governments around the world, we don't... because of law, privacy laws in the Channel Islands, we don't do any external reporting.
Okay, so in a sense, could we say that gold money as a system for transacting business is a parallel system?
Yeah, it is a parallel system. Once send national currency to gold money in order to purchase gold or silver. And once you make the exchange out of national currency into gold or silver, you now have gold or silver that's in a parallel payment system to the existing national currency banking system.
But if, for example, if all the currencies crash, okay, they crash the dollar, they crash the reserve currency, and they start to use special drawing rights, which is this basket of currencies, which they're not telling us yet what basket of currencies will be used or how long that will be a transitional form of currency, won't people be losing all their value and their purchasing power if they wait too long to move into a gold money system?
Yeah. You know, the gold price is going higher all of the time. So, you know, eventually you have to make the decision as to when you're going to use gold and silver to help protect your purchasing power. And it goes back to the point we were discussing before. What I basically recommend is viewed as a savings account. Every month or every quarter, every 4 months or 6 months, whenever you feel comfortable, regardless of what the price of gold or silver is at that moment in time, just move out of national currency into gold or silver and view that gold or silver to be your savings account. You know, a dollar cost averaging basis, is the best way to accumulate the precious metals. I've been saying this all decade long. And even though gold has done as well as it has, gold is still undervalued. So I think dollar cost averaging gold or silver, you know, going forward is definitely a very good strategy.
When I've shared about gold money with people, some people have said to me, look, there's only a finite amount of gold in the world, whereas with currency, you can just keep printing it. So there's only so much gold in the world to go around. Eventually, people are going to not be able to transact in gold money or silver money, et cetera, because there's only so much to go around. And some people have said because silver, you know, is most of it is in demand and the above ground amount of silver that's available is more limited and gold is often hoarded, that there's not going to be enough to go around to be in a gold money transaction system. What do you say to that?
Yeah, you know, the fact that there is a limited amount of gold is one of its greatest attributes. It can't be created out of thin air like paper currency. You can't have a central bank bailing out financial institutions by creating gold out of thin air like they've created dollars out of thin air to bail out all of these insolvent banks. So, you know, that's gold's greatest attribute. But it goes back to the point I made before. You have this above-ground stock of gold. It's now approximately 160,000 metric tons, and it grows by about 1.7% per annum, which is approximately equal to new wealth creation and world population growth. So you have this natural form of money. The second aspect to that is velocity. You know, you can have even a smaller amount of gold, but if it moves around much more quickly, it will be able to accomplish what you need to accomplish in terms of commercial transactions. So I don't think that that argument is correct, because I think most people are looking at gold more like they look at other currencies, other commodities, rather than looking at what gold really is. It's different from other forms of commodities because it's accumulated, it's not consumed.
So, but in your gold money system, I can use it to transact business. If people want to advertise with It's Rainmaking Time, if somebody wants to do a deal with my company, The Rainmaking Company, they can pay for services or do transactions via gold money and gold, silver, or platinum, correct?
Yeah, that's right. You can even, you know, price your transactions in terms of euros, for example. Let's say you have an import business in California and you're importing, you know, 5,000 euros worth of goods from somebody in Italy. You can pay for that transaction with gold online through gold money, and you actually, the weight of gold that transfers is the exact equivalent to those 5,000 euros at the prevailing exchange rate at the moment that you make the transaction. Or you can just transact with other people and say, yeah, you know, I'll do this for you for 1,000 gold grams, and you just pay 1,000 gold grams to completely avoid all national currencies.
So you don't think that you do not think that it matters if metals are in shorter supply in terms of only a certain amount of people will be able to get in? Can the whole world participate with gold money?
Yeah, we have customers in over 100 different countries around the world, and anybody who wants to, you know, open an account and they meet our application process can go ahead and transact and become an account holder in gold money.
And the last question I had, which is a very much part of complementing and completing the loop in this broadcast interview with you, is the following. Most attorneys, in my experience, are used to doing transactions and contracts relative to the reserve currency, which is U.S. dollars. Don't we need people to begin showing up and being trained in being able to write contracts for metal payments?
Yeah, and you know, that's legal to do under U.S. law. Anybody who wants to can write a contract in terms of gold. But you know, the first step is people actually have to start calculating the price of goods and services in terms of gold to truly understand what's happening to national currencies. So it's going to take a while, but I think as the problems with national currencies become increasingly serious, more people will turn to gold, and you know, hopefully people will continue to turn to gold money as they have been doing, you know, since we launched back in 2001.
And the last question is, if I'm pricing my goods and services in terms of gold money or gold grams, if we lose if the dollar crashes, which it's apparently on its way to crashing, as well as the euro, how do you attribute value for goods and services without something to compare it to? A context for the value usually is in a currency. What do you do?
Yeah, the value is in an item's usefulness. So it's a question of, you know, how the two individuals who are transacting, you know, view the item, how they value the item that they're transacting in. But again, it goes back to calculating the price of goods and services in terms of gold. You know, looking at barrels of crude oil in terms of gold, or how many silver dollars it takes to fill up the family car. You know, it's calculating prices of goods and services in terms of precious metals, which is the way it was under the classical gold standard. We just happened to call them pounds or dollars, but basically they were just pieces of paper circulating in place of gold.
So this is a whole mental state change, really. It's a paradigm change is what you're doing, is what you're offering, too. Not only a system, but a paradigm change.
Yeah, it's basically going back to the point where, you know, gold is a form of currency. Keep in mind, too, currencies, you know, terms like pound, mark, lira, franc, dirham, these are all weights. They're all weights of gold or weights of silver. It was only a dollar that was called something that wasn't a weight, and that was because of historical reasons in terms of a nickname that was given to the silver dollar, because it was the silver came from a valley in a German-speaking part of Europe, and the word for valley is Tal, so in German. So they started calling Talers, you know, coins from the valley, and Talers eventually became dollars. But all other currencies used terms that were a measure of weight, and they were weight of precious metals.
And the last question before we close is, what do you think, given your life and business experience internationally, it is going to take to expedite bringing mines to fruition?
I think it's going to take the collapse of the dollar, and I think the collapse of the dollar is coming. You know, I say that I often say that the bubble is not the internet, not the NASDAQ, not the stock market, not the real estate market. The big bubble is the dollar, and that bubble hasn't yet popped, but I think it's going to pop probably pretty soon. And by soon, I'm talking, maybe in 2010.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been interviewing James Turk, the founder of Gold Money and the author of The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. James, we look forward to having you back soon, and we're delighted that you took the time out of your day today in Spain to talk with us.
Thanks, Kim. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for being here. It's Rainmaking Time.